So Brother Randall prayed, going to make my lesson a little bit easier tonight. He prayed about us, you know, being in a rut. And I've been thinking about that a little bit because, you know, Brother Ken's preaching on it a little bit, trying to encourage us. And Brother Dana kind of, you know, reached out in that direction a little bit. And I've been thinking about that situation. I've been thinking, you know, looking at myself, I figure something out. And I'm sure about this. I'm part of the problem. I'm pretty sure of that. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Or maybe we won't. We'll see where it goes. But I believe I'm part of the problem. If there's a problem, somebody's got to be part of it. Okay. If I'm the only one, I'm the only one. Oh, okay. We got more? We got more? Okay. We might have a few more. But we got to really consider if there's a problem, and if there's a problem, and we're a church body, and we're a unit, and we make up the unit, where's the problem lie? So I've been reading this book by a guy named Simon Sinek, and the name of the book is Start with Why. And my introduction is going to come from some of the material in his book, so I want to give him credit. But it's pretty interesting because it ties in with what I want to talk about tonight. About, I don't know, in 1963, 250,000 people descended into Washington. 250,000 people, and if you look this event up, it was adults, it was children, it was men, women, it was all races, descended on to Washington. 250,000 is a lot of people. And if you go, after I tell you what the event was, if you go and look at some of the images, the mall was full. The mall in Washington was full. And it's a big area. That was before there was any internet. So no internet, no social media, no cell phones, not even any pagers at the time. So how did word get out and how did that kind of a movement happen in Washington at that time? Well, they came to hear a message from a speaker. And this speaker stood in front of those 250,000 people, and his backdrop was the Lincoln Memorial. Who's seen the Lincoln Memorial in person? Just seen it in pictures and so forth. It's a huge monument. It stands for something. It stands for something that Abraham Lincoln stood for. And it had a lot to do with integrity and honesty. And he did some important things during the war. And he also did Emancipation Proclamation, which changed the course of history forever in America. Well, this speaker stood in front of that monument, in front of those 250,000 people, and he talked about, I have a dream. And he would describe the environment across America that he saw in the future, and he would follow that with, I have a dream. And I have a dream, and he would describe this situation that he believed could make America better and make the world better. Well, there was a movement during that time that we all know about that did change the course of America. And you think about Martin Luther King, who traveled all over and spoke, and he wasn't the only one. There were others that were faces of that movement. But he had a unique ability to connect with the audience. Probably one of the best speakers I've ever read or watched ever. Just a phenomenal speaker. Now, if you know anything about the person, not a perfect person. Not necessarily the type of person, morally, ethically, that we might get behind. But all of us, most of us, could identify with his message. Most of us could say, yeah, I want to be the type of person that supports a movement that treats people properly, that respects people, that gives people the rights that they deserve, and gives people the opportunities in a country like this that they deserve. So we could be inspired by those words and leave an event like that and leave an interaction like that to go do something. Now, there are a lot of events you'll go to. There are a lot of gatherings you'll go to that will energize you. I'm going to go to this, I'm going to watch this infomercial, and then I'm going to exercise tomorrow and next week and next week. I'm energized to go do that. Well, energy runs out very quickly. Being energized doesn't necessarily cause us to go do things differently. But when we're inspired and we're connected to a cause, we'll put in the energy when it's not convenient to go do something. When we're connected with the why, that's what this book's about, the why. When we understand the why, the purpose of a movement or an initiative, then we'll put in the hard work and we'll make it happen if we can connect with that and we can align with that. He talks about why some organizations are successful and others aren't, why some companies are successful and others aren't, why some movements are successful and others aren't. And it has a lot to do with why that thing is happening. Trust me, I'm going somewhere. So about 60 years earlier, before this event, before 1963, in 1903, there was another movement happening across America. There was a guy named Samuel Pierpont Langley, and he was an astrophysicist, an astronomer, a mathematician. He was the secretary over the Smithsonian Institute. He had friends. You may recognize some of his friends. There was Thomas Edison. He kind of rubbed shoulders with them. He rubbed shoulders with some of the rich folks like Carnegie. He was connected very closely with the government and the War Department. He actually, you guys know who Rudyard Kipling is? He's an old writer, Christian writer actually, wrote books and poetry. And if you're interested in any kind of poetry, there's a poem that I had to learn in the sixth grade that I never forgot the existence of the poem, but I've forgotten the actual recital of it. But it's If by Rudyard Kipling. It's a phenomenal poem that I'd recommend. But Rudyard Kipling actually wrote in one of his writings about meeting Samuel Langley. And he wrote about, it was an interesting interaction because he got to watch Samuel Langley demonstrate a machine that he had invented or that he had built that was kind of like a canister. It ran off of steam. It kind of puttered around. And it would actually, it was heavier than air, but it would actually float up into the air and float across the air. And eventually it landed in the river and everyone laughed at him. So Samuel Langley had a fascination for the race to human flight. Now he had connections in the War Department and they gave him $50,000 to fund his effort in the early 1900s, late 1800s. And from the Smithsonian Institute, he got $20,000. So now he has $70,000 to invest in the pursuit of heavier-than-air, controlled human flight with power, powered human flight. So he had the ability and the name recognition to go and hire the best mathematicians, the best physicists, the best folks to consult with. He could get the best equipment, the best materials. He had access to the materials that the military had access to. And he assembled the best team to go achieve flight. And his concept was, it was very much like the airplanes we see today, kind of a canvas-type wing, the way they did back in the old days. And he had a houseboat that he parked on the Potomac. And on top of this houseboat, he had configured a catapult. And he would set the catapult, set the plane on the houseboat. And he had a guy named Charles Manley that was his pilot, test dummy. And they would try to fly these things. So the first attempt of Samuel Langley was they put Manley in the seat, kind of in a laying down fashion, and they exercised the catapult. The plane flew, caught on the catapult, kind of crumbled up, and fell into the river, and into the Potomac. I guess that was his stomping grounds. So he one of the newspapers said it looked like a wad of mortar being thrown into the river. All right, so that was attempt number one. Second attempt, a little bit later, set the second plane up. They had rebuilt it through the catapult. The plane went straight up like this and then went back this way into the river on top of the pilot. He almost drowned, got him out of there. And the $70,000 was spent. And all the friends that Langley had that had supported him in getting the funding started turning on him. The folks in Congress started saying, hey, the only thing Langley's ever flown was our budget away. And that sort of thing. So nothing's changed in politics. If you're high, you're high. They're with you. If you got a little struggle going on, they're somewhere else. So Langley was out of money. He was losing support. And it turns out that his venture was about him trying to make a name for himself. It was important to Langley that he be a credible person in history and in America, and he wanted to be ranked among the Thomas Edisons, the folks of that day that were doing fundamental things in America, and he wanted to be famous. So he was able to hire the best people with the money from the government and equip the best situation so that they could fly first and they could make him famous. So after that second failed flight, there is by the way, he had the newspapers with him all the time. They were documenting everything, trying to build his name up, and he was loving that situation. So had anyone heard of Samuel Langley before I gave that name out? Okay, yes? You probably know about Langley Air Force Base. Yeah, so he did have enough credibility and enough reputation in pioneering flight that he got one of the oldest Air Force bases named after him. And the first fighter wing, by the way, which, they take care of business. They take care of our F-22s also. A little plug for F-22. So there was another couple of folks that were working on heavier-than-air, controlled flight. You've probably heard of Orville and Wilbur Wright. So 9 days after Langley's second attempt, Orville and Wilbur actually achieved flight. And they achieved it for 59 seconds. They flew about 110 feet, and they controlled their flight down to the ground and landed. And they did it on a budget of about $1,000. And they were two bicycle shop owners. One of them didn't finish high school. The other one did have his high school education. And they had a passion around mass transit. They said, and they would teach, and they would promote, someday flying is going to be as common. You're going to load airplanes the way you load buses today. That was the vision they had for the future. It sounds a little bit crazy to me because after Langley had failed his second flight, one of the newspaper articles said it'll be 1 million years before man achieves flight. So something that's never been done before is so out of reach for most of us to think about. But the Wright brothers had the vision of tomorrow pretty clearly because they've described our today. And Martin Luther King had the vision of tomorrow because he described in his I Have a Dream speech pretty much what we're experiencing today. He said he would like to see people of all races sit down at the same table and enjoy a meal. I think we do that today. There's a lot of things we do today that was described in his speech. So the Wright brothers were tied to achieving a flight situation so that America could move to the next level, so that America could prosper. And oh, by the way, they could make a little money too, because they were entrepreneurs. They did own a bike shop, and they did want to make money. But they inspired their team to go work toward that purpose for the greater good. Said all that to say this. It matters why we're doing something. It matters a great deal about the why on what we focus our energy on. It matters a great deal why we are here at Liberty Baptist Church. Why are you here? Some of us, it's become habit, and that's okay. That's okay. It's a very good habit to have. Some of us are part of the church, and that's a good thing too, because we're part of a community. But why? What connects you here? What was it that brought you here, and what were you feeling when you came? What was it that brought you to the Lord, and what was it that was going on in your life just prior to that and leading up to that? Why? What's this all about? When I think about why, I think about David. And over in, let's see, where are we? We'll get to some scripture here. Over in 1 Samuel 17, it's a familiar story. We know the story of David and Goliath. And David was a young boy that wasn't invited to the battle. He was sent to carry a picnic, basically, to his brothers. He didn't belong there. When he got there, he saw a situation of Goliath in the valley, embarrassing everyone around, calling out God's army on the ridge. And he was, what's the famous words? He said, "Is there not a cause?" Oh, there's a cause, all right. And David was so connected with that cause as a young man that he was not worried about becoming famous, because no one knew his name, and going out there and getting dead is no way to get famous. He was worried about the cause. He wasn't worried about wealth, because there was no wealth in it. He saw that there was a battle between the God's army and the Philistines, and he saw no one filling the gap, so he stepped up to fill that gap in that cause. And he didn't trust Saul's armor. He wasn't even big enough to fill it. He hadn't proven it. So he went out and took Goliath out because he believed in the cause. Now, if you reverse back into David's life a little bit, back in 1 Samuel 16, there's a situation there where God tells Samuel that he says, in verse 1, he says, "How long will thou mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill thine horn with oil and go. I will send thee to Jesse of the Bethlehemite, for I have provided me a king among his sons." So you guys know the story. Samuel goes to Jesse's house, and Jesse parades in front of Samuel, one by one, his sons. And one by one, Samuel rejects and says, "No, that's not the one. But God has sent me here to anoint a king. So, do you have any more sons?" And God says, in those scriptures, he says, "Don't look on the stature. Don't look on the countenance. You see things, Samuel, as men see things. But God sees things as God sees things." And ultimately, he selected David to be anointed king. So, at that point in time, God had created a new king over Israel. It was no longer Saul. As soon as God destines something, as soon as God anoints something, you can be sure that something will come to fruition. David was the type of boy that God saw a future king in that boy. And he anointed him as king at that time. If God has put a purpose in your heart, and you can't see the realization of that purpose where you are right now, just be assured that if God's anointed that purpose will come to fruition. If you can stay tuned in and be in your spot and let God work that through you. David, an amazing character that left that situation, continues to tend to the sheep, goes into a situation where Goliath, where a soldier is needed and a warrior is needed, he steps up and fills that role. Now the Bible goes on to say that Saul had a worrisome spirit on him that God had given him. Saul was in a mess. Saul once had God's anointment, and Saul got too big for his britches, and he started making decisions outside of his realm of purpose and outside of his place. Matter of fact, he was even willing to take the place of the man of God for a minute and perform a sacrifice because he was tired of waiting on Samuel. And God shut the door on him and said, you can't be my anointed in that situation. So God had anointed a new king. This troublesome spirit that was on Saul kept him anxious, kept him worried. And they said, how can we calm the king who is anxious and worried? Well, we know this young lad that can play music. that can be calming. So they go get David, and David plays music that calms the king. David is starting to get a recognition amongst the king and amongst the kingdom. He didn't go kill Goliath for fame, but the minute he took that head of Goliath, he became a legend. And at the minute those soldiers went back into their homes and into their towns and told that story, David became bigger than life to everyone around. So David is starting to build stature amongst Saul, amongst Saul's kingdom, and amongst all of Saul's armies and all of Saul's people. As a matter of fact, David became quite a warrior. And he stayed true. He was a true soldier for the king. And he killed God's enemies as necessary. And the people would sing songs about him in the streets. Y'all remember the songs? It had something to do with David kills his tens of thousands and Saul kills his thousands, his hundreds. That's bad mojo right there. Because when you're at the top of a kingdom, you're paranoid that someone's trying to take you down. And it's even worse because you know that you've messed up your anointment. Saul knew he'd messed up his anointment with God. And he knew he didn't have God's blessing. So David is starting to be recognized as a powerful man. As a powerful man amongst men. Saul gets David in his sights as a threat. Saul starts to pursue David. It says in the scripture that he took 3,000 men and went and pursued David to take him out. Now, in this pursuit, David skirted death many times. But there was one time that I want to draw out where David had a handful of men and they went and hid in a cave. You guys know this story? So they hid in the cave and Saul came in to the cave to rest. Saul was asleep. David knew he was being pursued to be killed. But he also knew that he was appointed king. What would you do? Maybe you would just make things right at that point in time. Saul's wanting to take me down. I've got him right here. God already said I was king anyway. Let's just get this thing going. But what he did was, just to show, maybe he had a little bravado, just to show who he was, he went and snipped a little bit of the garment off of Saul. And I want to go to that verse because there's some important words in that verse, in that story. So David spared Saul. It's over in 1 Samuel 24. In verse 4, it says, "And the men of David said unto him, Behold the day of which the Lord said unto thee, Behold, I will deliver thine enemy into thine hand, and thou mayest do to him as it shall seem unto thee. Then David arose and cut off the skirt of Saul's robe privily. And it came to pass afterward that David's heart smote him because he had cut off Saul's skirt." Verse 6, "And he said unto his men, The Lord forbid that I should do this thing unto my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch forth mine hand against him, seeing he is anointed of the Lord." At this point in time, if you look into David's heart and the fact that he had done this thing and it smote his heart and he felt convicted about it, tells me that David was strongly connected to the why in his life. He was connected to God's way, God's rules, God's principles. David was sacrificing to be the soldier for Christ that he was supposed to be. He had not lost his vision of why. David demonstrated through most of his life this connection. But something happens. Something happens with David. In 2 Samuel chapter 11, verse 1. And it came to pass, after the year was expired, and the time when kings go forth to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him, and all of Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon, and besieged Rabbah. But David tarried still in Jerusalem. Now, the David that killed tens of thousands and thousands, the David that stepped forth as a child to Goliath, the David that protected the sheep and killed beasts with his bare hands, decided that while his soldiers were going to go to battle, that he was going to stay behind. That's not the David that we've been talking about tonight. The king goes in with his soldiers when it's time for battle. The king doesn't stay behind, but he stayed behind. And we know the story. David looked across the city and he saw Bathsheba on the rooftop. He sent for Bathsheba. Bathsheba became with child, another man's wife. It gets worse. He sends for Bathsheba's husband because he finds out that he has a child out of wedlock. The husband comes home with the intent to trick him that it would be his child. Husband's name is Uriah. He says, I'm a soldier of honor. I'm not going to go into my house and enjoy the warmth and the food and the situation while my soldiers are out at battle. I'm going to sleep at the gates. So he refused to go in and do that thing which David had planned. David was distraught. So David didn't go into battle, and now he started scheming. What's going on here? What's he connected to? It's certainly not his purpose and his why. He sends Uriah out to battle, tells him to put him at the front of the battle, the hottest part of the battle, and then step back to get Uriah killed. That's exactly what happens. So the man that was, his heart was smoten, was smote from cutting a garment, is now committing murder to cover his name. Something's wrong. He's lost his connection with the wine. David goes ahead and has to, he marries Bathsheba. He's disgraced. His people know what has happened. The child that was born between David and Bathsheba was killed or died. Three more of his children died. David got into a bad situation, and an embarrassing situation for a king, and a situation that doesn't make sense for a king that rose up the way he did. He lost his connection with his purpose. He lost his connection with his why. So David repented. David spent time with God. David got his forgiveness. Eventually, David had another child. David's child's name was Solomon. Solomon became one of the wisest and one of the greatest kings. And eventually, David's bloodline led to Christ being born out of that bloodline. So God chose David in the beginning, anointed him throughout his life. As long as David stayed connected to the why, David prospered. As soon as David disconnected from that, David started to fall. As soon as David reconnected with that, David began to prosper. You see a pattern here? So I said all that to have us think just a little bit about what Brother Randall mentioned earlier. Because I'm not the pastor, and it's inappropriate for me to touch certain subjects. I'm not your mama. I don't get to judge or tell. I'm just presenting information. But You know, when our pastor says, quite bluntly, I've never pastored so many people that want to do so little, that connects with me. I'm one of the people and I'm one of the little. I remember, and I'll just speak to me because I'm not going to speak to you. That's not my place. But I remember some 20 years ago, the situation I was in and the way the Word changed my life, this church changed my life. As Brother Dana said, my connection with her, with the church, changed my life. And when you're connected with that why, you'll work on behalf of that why. And you want other people to experience that. And you want other people to get that help. And we want to grow, and we want to reach, and we want to do things when they're inconvenient. We can all get excited and get energized and go take food to someone, especially someone that we like or someone that we hang out with when something's wrong. But it takes a connection to the why to go get that food when you get that call and go deliver that food when it's most inconvenient and do it with a smile and not be disgruntled. Because the why is people need love. And the why is we're an extension of God's love. It takes connection with the why to teach the kids that don't always pay attention, that always have energy, and to do it week after week, and to be prepared, and to be excited about it. You can't get energized to do that because we're tired, and we've got a lot to do. But it takes a connection to the why to do that. And like I said, I'm part of the problem. Brother Ken talked about connection to our phones, connection to our work, connection to the world. I got all that going on. And I need to leave energy to stay connected to the why and to work on behalf of the why. Maybe we all do. So, it matters the purpose. It matters the why. You know, social media has become a really interesting thing, and I love to make fun of it, so I'm going to take this opportunity now to do that. I see the people we create and the images we create on this pick Facebook. And I always picture some of these folks when they're typing love. Let me see what I can think of here. Beautiful summer day, loving my family. The smell of jasmine wafting through the window and mixing with the freshly baked cookies. And I picture them turning away from the keyboard. Could you quiet down? Could you shut it? I'm trying to concentrate. Hashtag loving my family. Hashtag life. Hashtag kids are everything. Let's get in the car. We're late. That's what I picture. Sorry, I had fun with that. We can't pretend it into existence. It doesn't work. It has to be created in the trenches with dirty hands, with hard work, with energy expended. Sometimes long hours, most of the time when it's inconvenient. A true look at ourselves, not our profiles. A true look in the mirror. A true examination of our souls. A true look at the results we're getting from the actions we're taking. Because sometimes we like to pretend we're getting better results than we are. And sometimes we're just not. So the only way to adjust our actions is to adjust our actions and to reconnect with that why. I think I've said enough. Thank you.